From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. A historic day is unfolding in Washington. Right now, members of the House of Representatives are debating two articles of impeachment against President Trump for abusing his power by pressuring a foreign leader to investigate a political rival and for obstructing Congress's investigation of it. Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern led Democrats' defense of the proceedings.
Madam Speaker, we are being tested on something greater than our ability to toe a party line, something more than our ability to score the next great television soundbite. This is a democracy-defining moment.
Let's bring in our political strategist, Bill Press, a Democrat and host of the Bill Press podcast. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Jeremy.
And Alice Stewart, Republican strategist, joins us today from Little Rock, right, Alice? Right.
That is correct.
Okay,
hi, Jeremy.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So let me start with you, Bill. How big a moment is this after all that has led up to it?
It's huge. It really is. You started out by saying it's an historic day. It is. It is only the third time in our history, as everyone has pointed out, that an American president has been impeached or will have been impeached by the end of the day. It's a historic day. I think it's a sad day. I think it's sad that someone could so openly, brazenly abuse the powers of the office of the presidency, and the decision about whether he should be held responsible turns out to be a strict party line decision on one side, certainly without any apparent interest in the facts of the case. And I think we know how it's going to play out, and then it moves on to the Senate. I don't think it's a moment that anyone should be gleeful or cheery about.
Alice, how do you view this day?
It is a somber day, and it's a sad day for many reasons, specifically the founders of our country and those who wrote the Constitution never intended for there to be single-party impeachment, which is exactly what we have. And here in Little Rock, I was actually in Little Rock when Clinton was going through the impeachment process. And the big difference between this and what we had 21 years ago was that President Clinton lied to a federal grand jury. There was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It was a clear case of impeachment. This is much different. And we've heard a lot of talk from Republicans and Democrats as we've gone through this process. But this morning, Jerry Nadler said something that really jumped out at me, being critical of Republicans who were opposed to impeachment. He said, we cannot rely on impeachment to correct misconduct in terms of what happens next. Or he actually said, we cannot rely on an upcoming election to correct misconduct. Well, at the same time, Democrats cannot rely on impeachment to correct an election they didn't like. This is what it boils down to. Democrats didn't like the past election, and this is their remedy for it. And this is not what impeachment is all about.
Alice, if I may, Jeremy, just to jump in a second. I mean, that's just silly. This is not about whether or not Democrats liked what happened in 2016. It's what Donald Trump did on July 25 and before and after, trying to subvert the next American election. But I just want to add that there are two things that are different about the Clinton impeachment, which, by the way, was 21 years ago tomorrow,
right.
December
right.
19. One is that it was not exactly a strict partisan vote. There were 31 Democrats in the House who voted to open the impeachment inquiry. There were 5 Democrats in the Senate who voted to convict President Clinton. So if the Republicans are all hiding behind Donald Trump, they can't complain that's just one-sided. It'd be easier for them to fix it by maybe facing the facts and voting the right way. But the other thing I would point out is I can't believe that Republicans were so gleeful to impeach Bill Clinton for, yes, lying under oath about a consensual act of oral sex. And now they totally ignore a president who bribed a foreign president to influence the next election. It's night and day, the difference between what these two presidents are accused
of.
Well,
let's listen to hear to what President Trump has been saying about this. Yesterday, reporters asked him if he accepted any responsibility at all for the impeachment vote.
No, I don't take any. Zero, to put it mildly. They took a perfect phone call that I had with the president of Ukraine, an absolutely perfect call. You know it. They all know it. Nothing was said wrong in that call. To impeach the president of the United States for that is a disgrace.
Alice, let me ask you, let's assume that the House impeaches President Trump, and let's assume that he is acquitted by the Senate, and let's even assume that he gets reelected next year. What lesson should he take from what has just happened?
Well, I will go out on a limb and say that all three of those assumptions you just made will come to fruition. That will happen. But the lesson that the president will learn and Republicans will learn is that Democrats will stop at nothing to pursue their agenda.
So he shouldn't take any lessons for his own behavior from this?
Look, Jeremy, any lessons or any type of consequences or any repercussions, if the people feel like he should suffer or face as a result of this phone call, he will face those on Election Day. And if he is reelected, then that is what the will of the people states and what they want. And to that end, Democrats who have been pushing this impeachment line for all these weeks as we've had this hearing, they have not moved the needle in any way, shape, or form. We're still looking the latest polls, the average of the polls, 51% of people do not want to see this president impeached. So this is not a winning argument for the Democrats. And to the president's end and many Republicans' end, this will only serve to embolden Republicans and even swing over some independents who may be frustrated with this process because this is what they're seeing in Congress.
Bill.
Again, if I may, as I said the last time we were together, forget the polls. The polls are meaningless. They should have nothing to do with this conversation. Yes, 90% of Americans support background checks, but Republicans don't say, oh, look at the polls. We got to pass it. Now suddenly they're concerned about polls when it comes to impeachment. And I think back to your question, Jeremy, what the president ought to learn, I would hope would learn from this, is that nobody, not even the president of the United States, is above the law. That's what's at stake here. But unfortunately, I think he will walk away from this knowing that as long as his cowardly Republicans stand behind him, he can get away with anything. He can trash the Constitution. He can bribe a foreign president. He can undermine our very democracy. And these cowardly Republicans in the Congress don't give a damn.
Okay. As we look forward to January, the probable trial in the Senate, just quickly let me ask each of you, starting with you, Alice, do you think that there will be witnesses in that Senate trial?
I assume there will be, but they may not be the ones that everyone is certainly hoping
like
for.
Like Mick Mulvaney
and
John Bolton.
John Bolton, no. I don't expect them to come forward any more than I expect Hunter Biden to come forward or Adam Schiff to come forward. The Senate will go about this in a very judicious manner. I think it's in everyone's best interest to go ahead and move forward and put this behind us so we can focus on more important things that the American people are concerned with. But that remains to be seen. But anyone who's expecting to see any new revelations come out as opposed to the Senate is going to go in there, get the job done, and move forward.
Bill, do you think that there'll be any witnesses?
I would agree with Alice. I don't think the witnesses that everybody would love to see, like John Bolton or Hunter Biden or Joe Biden, are going to show up. Mm-hmm. There may be some witnesses, but I think the key question is, will there be a fair trial? And I must say, when Lindsey Graham says, yeah, I don't consider myself a fair juror, when Mitch McConnell says, I'm going to let the White House counsel decide who testifies and how long we stay and what we do, I don't see any prospect or any hope of a fair trial in the Senate under Mitch McConnell.
And that's exactly how Republicans view the hearing that went on in the House under Nancy Pelosi.
Alice, they were invited to testify in the House, and Donald Trump said, nobody testify, nobody send over any documents, we are not going to cooperate. The fact that they were not there in the House is the White House's fault. They held back.
Let's spend the last minute and a half we have talking about 2020. And there's a debate tomorrow night between 7 Democratic presidential candidates, Biden, Sanders, Warren, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, Yang, and Steyer. Bill, first to you. What do you think the candidates need to do briefly?
I think they need to hold their own tomorrow night. And I would hope that they will talk about impeachment and what it means to the country. And then I don't think, frankly, from any of these debates, we've seen the needle move so far. I regret the fact that Cory Booker is not going to be in the debate. Julian Castro is not going to be in the debate. So except for Andrew Yang, it's going to be an all-white, all-white person show, which I think is not good for the Democratic Party.
Well, and do you think, Alice, that since Joe Biden has been gaining a little bit of momentum that he may have lost earlier on, that somebody's going to go after him again tomorrow?
Without a doubt. He will have a target on his back as well as Pete Buttigieg, I believe. And the real takeaway from this is the fact that we're seeing the two of the more moderate candidates, Biden and Buttigieg, who are gaining strength in the polls. And this should serve as a lesson to the other candidates that those that are too far to the left are the ones that are falling in the polls. And we can also take a lesson from the Brexit vote. The ones that were too far to the extreme did not win. So the bottom line is the more moderating voices seem to be doing well in the Democratic primary.
You know, as we think about Brexit, the next step now is going to be whether Britain can stay together because Scotland wants out now. So we will continue to monitor that. Alice Stewart, Republican strategist, and Bill Press, the Democrat, host of the Bill Press podcast. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks
Jeremy. Guys. Merry Christmas.
You too.
The chatbot on Sheila's phone is supposed to ask her questions, but when she starts asking it questions, it sends her poetry.
Secret dwelling place, mysteries held in the dirt. Time has other plans.
What happens when you treat artificial intelligence with love? On the new episode of Invisibilia from NPR.
When you think of country music, you probably think of Nashville. But there's a city here in Southern California that should be mentioned in the same breath. It's Bakersfield, often called Nashville West. The city has its own Music Hall of Fame, and its musical history is even reflected in the motto on the website, The Sound of Something Better. The musical legacy is now documented in a box set called The Bakersfield Sound, 1940 to 1974.
Further on in California, over mountains and plains, to the San Joaquin Valley we drew up our reins. For 4 years today, we've lived it just fine in the state of California where the sun always shines.
That's Mary Sullivan, recorded in 1941, singing Sunny California. Historian Scott B. Bomer wrote the liner notes for this box set. He joins me in the studio. Scott, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So this must have been pretty fun to work on.
It was a blast. It was really a labor of love. I actually grew up in Nashville and grew up around the music industry. And when I moved to California and found out how much country music history there was here, I just fell in love with it. And so it was really wonderful to just really dive in.
Now, that's something that many people probably don't know or think of when they think of California, and specifically Bakersfield. What can you say about the Bakersfield sound? What is the Bakersfield sound?
In the most general sense, the Nashville sound is thought of as a little bit more smooth, more polished, more refined. Mm. The Bakersfield sound is regarded as something that's a little rougher, a little twangier, a little edgier.
Yeah, we rock.
What it really comes down to is in Bakersfield, the music that they were making was music to dance to. Mm. And in Nashville, it was really music that was made for sitting and listening. And that comes from really the story of Dust Bowl refugees who came out to California. It's that Grapes of Wrath story. And so many of the people who were pioneers of the Bakersfield sound really adopted that as the story of their own family and said, you know, that was really an accurate thing. And so these folks moved from places like Oklahoma and Arkansas and Texas, and they came out to California and they preserved their traditions. They preserved, you know, the type of communities that they had back home, and that included the music. And these were hardworking people. They worked in oil fields. They worked picking crops. At the end of the day, or at the end of the week, they wanted to blow off steam. Mm. So dancing was, you know, going to honky-tonks and beer halls. And that's really the roots of why Bakersfield's music is a little bit more upbeat, more drum-oriented, more danceable.
Yeah, more danceable. And this box set actually starts with field recordings of migrant workers. Can you point to a specific song on the set that typifies the sound that you're talking about of the 1940s?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because the recordings that were done at the camps, and these were government camps where essentially the government had to step in because people were living in absolute squalor who had gone out to California in search of a better life. The Roosevelt administration stepped in and set up these camps where people could live. And the recordings that you hear from those camps were very much just an acoustic guitar, kind of folk song oriented. You see reflections of artists like Jimmy Rogers, early country artists. But then as you get into the 1940s, you really get into this Western swing thing where there's fiddles and larger bands. And Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys were a really popular Western swing group that actually relocated to California in the 1940s. And they played up and down the West Coast, actually played in Bakersfield every week in 1946. And so there's some great recordings on the box set of Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys live in a Bakersfield radio station. And that really gives you a sense of the kind of music that people were dancing to, kind of in the pre-fully electrified era.
Merrill Haggard once said, referring to himself and Buck Owens, that we represent the end results of all the years of country music in this town, Bakersfield. Let's take Buck Owens first. What place does he hold in the history of Bakersfield and that sound he's talking about?
Buck Owens is the archetype of the Bakersfield sound. Buck Owens had his own band, whereas artists in Nashville typically would record with studio musicians. Buck recorded and toured with his own band. And it was a pretty upbeat, revved up, again, danceable kind of sound that was pretty unique in that time. And you hear pedal steel guitar, two electric guitars, bass and drums. Buck didn't write a lot of, you know, crying in your beer type songs. He wrote a lot of upbeat, feel good, you know, roll down your windows kind of songs. And Buck really understood, he worked at a radio station for a time, and he understood that it was important to make your records sound great coming out of your car radio, because he knew that's how people listened
that's
to music.
That's how people listened, yeah.
And, you know, so he really kind of perfected that thing. And I think that when people say the Bakersfield sound, almost what they mean is the Buck Owens sound. He's the true embodiment of it.
Let's listen to a little bit of that, The Second Fiddle by Buck Owens.
I'll play second fiddle to your new love while it lasts. Just like all the others I played for in the past. Why can't I be a leader and play a leading part? Why must I always have to play second fiddle in your heart?
As you mentioned, Owens is, of course, the guy, and he's also a Country Music Hall of Famer, as is Haggard. How rooted in Bakersfield is Merle Haggard's music as well?
Well, Merle Haggard is one of the few people who was actually born in Bakersfield. A lot of these other folks who were creating what we now call the Bakersfield sound were coming there as children from places like Texas and Arkansas and Oklahoma. Buck's mom and dad had migrated out to California from Oklahoma, but he was born there. And he was actually raised in a train car that his father converted into a small house for their family. So Merle was a true son of Bakersfield. He grew up in that environment. And you know, in addition to Buck Owens, Merle Haggard he's the other pillar. Those are the twin pillars of the Bakersfield sound. And very different in a lot of ways. You know, they worked with a lot of the same musicians. They had similar sounds at times. But where Buck was really all about that upbeat, fun kind of music, Merle was called the poet of the common man.
And poet of the common man.
He wrote some really insightful and thoughtful, reflective kind of songs about the migrant experience in California and about heartbreak. And, you know, he just was one of those rare people who was gifted as a true musical poet. And, you know, I put him up there with Bob Dylan or Woody Guthrie, you know, the icons of American songwriting.
Let's hear what you're talking about here with Merle Haggard's California Cotton Fields.
California cotton fields, where labor camps were filled with worried men with broken dreams. California cotton fields, as close to wealth as daddy ever came.
Can you talk a little bit about the influence of Bakersfield on other places, on the world? You talked about how radio came into play and how these two pillars really influenced other artists. But give us a sense of how that sound traveled.
Yeah, it's funny because I think today people who maybe are not really into country music, but they just kind of have an idea maybe of what country music is, they're probably more apt to be thinking of Bakersfield than they are to be thinking of the stuff that's coming out of Nashville.
Really?
Bakersfield
yeah.
is that real honky-tonk, twangy,
yes.
electric guitars, pedal steel guitar, you know, and I think if people just have a rudimentary understanding of, well, what is country music? That's kind of what they think about. And so oddly enough, I think Bakersfield influenced the public concept of what country music is almost more than any other strain of country music's history. And you know, Ken Burns recently did this fantastic country music documentary and really shone a spotlight on all of the various roots and branches that make up country music's complex story. Mm-hmm. But Bakersfield is so important in that. And it really, I think, set what Buck Owens and Merle Haggard did was take that music from a local musical scene, introduced it to the world in a way that people really just latched onto, and it had reverberations that we continue to hear in modern country music today.
This is very fascinating. I can't wait to listen to your entire box set, which I can't carry on a plane. It's kind of heavy.
It's a little big. 8 pounds, I believe it is.
8 pounds.
Eight pounds.
But beautiful artwork and such a rich history. A booklet, 224 pages, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That is a book in itself. Thank you so much for your time. Scott B. Bomar, he is the sound historian for the new box set of the Bakersfield Sound from 1940 to 1974. Scott, thank you.
Thanks, Tanya.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
If you're planning to travel over the next week for the holidays, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that conditions are supposed to be fairly mild for much of the U.S. without any of the major storms that foiled some people's Thanksgiving travel plans this year. The bad news is it's going to be another record-setting week for the sheer volume of people traveling. Let's bring in Seth Kaplan, Here and Now transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
Okay, so let's start with the bad news. More than 115 million Americans planning to travel more than 50 miles for the holidays this year. That's up about 4% over last year. What are the worst travel windows to avoid?
On the road, Jeremy, it's the 2 days after Christmas, Thursday and Friday, the 26th and 27th. That's because the pre-Christmas travel is kind of more spread out among more days just based on where Christmas falls this year in the middle of the week. In the air, Friday and Saturday, those same dates are busy, but the busiest of all, this Friday and Saturday, the 20th and 21st. I should say Thursday and Friday after, and then Friday and Saturday before the 20th and 21st.
Mm-hmm. And only about 5% of Americans are planning to fly, although those numbers are up too. How are ticket prices on the airlines this year?
They don't look all that different from last year because airlines have added about as many more seats as there are more people traveling. Travel up about 3% this year, according to the airline industry trade group. But the lack of MAXes in the air, the 737 MAXes, it's at a time like this when fares are higher than they would otherwise be because it's at peak times when airlines just get every airplane up into the sky. So with some of those planes missing in the end, it is supply and demand economics, fares at least a little bit higher than they would be if those planes were there.
And the top domestic destinations this year are Orlando and Anaheim, California, and Honolulu. So I'm thinking Orlando and Anaheim, Disney. Everybody's going to Disneyland and Disney World.
Exactly. Hey, the Angels, Major League Baseball, don't play this time of year, right? So if people are going to Anaheim, that's exactly why. And in fact, if you look over the list of top 10 destinations, almost all of them are sunshine destinations. The notable example, New York City coming in at number 7 on that list.
Now, in terms of a white Christmas, as we said, the conditions aren't going to be – there's not going to be big storms. So are there going to be any places that will see a white Christmas this year?
Yeah, that's even within the weather forecast, kind of a good news, bad news scenario, like what you said at the outset, right? The good news may be good for travel, the bad news. Yeah, although we are still a week out, so it's hard to pinpoint, and there still could be surprises. Generally speaking, the chances tend to be better out west because the snow just starts earlier. Mm-hmm. Even snowy places in the east don't get it as early. But that said, yeah, the long-term outlook for now looks just warmer than usual in general. Even Anchorage, Alaska, the Washington Post noted they've had 33 consecutive white Christmases in a row. They are at risk of not having a white Christmas this year.
Okay, now I'm going to give you a really hard question with 15 seconds. Mm-hmm. How does de-icing work?
Right, and I'll explain the history of the world if I have an extra few seconds, right? Yeah, it's not just about how cold it is. You also need precipitation. So it could be really cold, but not a problem, whereas it could just kind of be 20 degrees, and if you have snow, you're going to wait at the airport for that fluid to come on and get the ice off the plane.
Seth Kaplan, you did it. Here and Now transportation analyst. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you next week.
Jeremy, thank you.
As the full House prepares to vote today on articles of impeachment against President Trump, let's listen to some of what's happened so far. A number of procedural issues were debated early on before Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi took to the floor to address lawmakers.
My colleagues, this morning and every morning, when we come together, members rise and pledge allegiance to the flag. Every day, all across America, children in school, members of the military, officials, and those civically engaged also pledge allegiance to the flag. Let us recall what that pledge says. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. The republic for which it stands is what we are here to talk about today. A republic, if we can keep it. We gather today under the dome of this temple of democracy to exercise one of the most solemn powers that this body can take, the impeachment of the President of the United States. No member, regardless of party or politics, comes to Congress to impeach a president. But every one of us, as our first act as a member of Congress, stood on this historic House floor before our beautiful American flag and raised our hands in this sacred oath. I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So help me God. For 230 years, members have taken that sacred oath, which makes us custodians of the Constitution. When our founders declared independence and established a new nation, they crafted a system of government unlike one ever seen before, a republic. starting with the sacred words, "We the people." For centuries, Americans have fought and died to defend democracy for the people. But very sadly now, our founders' vision of a republic is under threat from actions from the White House. That is why today, as Speaker of the House, I solemnly and sadly open the debate on the impeachment of the President of the United States. If we do not act now, we would be derelict in our duty. It is tragic that the President's reckless actions make impeachment necessary. He gave us no choice.
Republicans see it differently. Here's Congressman Michael Burgess of Texas addressing the allegations against the president.
Turning to the case upon which the argument is based, we had a whistleblower. A not a fact witness, a whistleblower who never appeared before any member of Congress that we know of, a whistleblower complaint concerning a congratulatory call between President Trump and President Zelensky of the Ukraine. The whistleblower is known to have had contact with Chairman Schiff's staff, while Republicans were denied any contact. The whistleblower complaint is not based on firsthand knowledge, and the call transcript that was to support impeachment reveals nothing more than a congratulatory phone call. Look, a request for investigation as to how American foreign aid will be spent does not equal soliciting election interference. The evidence brought before us does not amount to a high crime. Indeed, it does not amount to any crime. Democrats claim that we must protect the integrity of our election. Look, if you really cared, then I have to ask, what are we missing while we've been focused on impeachment? We tied up the Intelligence Committee. We tied up the Judiciary Committee. And, oh, by the way, the Ways and Means Committee had to give up their room. They couldn't even meet while you were doing all of this. So this impeachment investigation is being painted as a protection against future interference, when in reality, President Trump's request looks back at the 2016 election. Russia is the winner in this exchange because they have disrupted the process.
Gentleman's time's expired. Gentleman from Massachusetts.
I yield back to the gentleman from Oklahoma.
We also heard today from Democrat Gerald Nadler, chair of the House Judiciary Committee. He outlined the first article of impeachment and then the second.
The president faces a second article of impeachment for his efforts to obstruct our investigation of his misconduct. The Constitution grants the sole power of impeachment to the House of Representatives. Within our system of checks and balances, the president may not decide for himself what constitutes a valid impeachment inquiry, nor may he ignore lawful subpoenas or direct others to do so. Many presidents, including President Trump, have asserted privileges and other objections to specific subpoenas. But only President Trump has ordered the categorical defiance of a congressional investigation, the automatic rejection of all subpoenas. The president is not above the law, and he should be impeached for this as well. Congress cannot wait for the next election to address this misconduct. President Trump has demonstrated a clear pattern of wrongdoing. This is not the first time he has solicited foreign interference in an election, has been exposed, and has attempted to obstruct the resulting investigation. We cannot rely on the next election as a remedy for presidential misconduct when the president threatens the very integrity of that election. He has shown us he will continue to put his selfish interests above the good of the country. We must act without delay. By his actions, President Trump has broken his oath of office. His conduct continues to undermine our Constitution and threaten our next election. His actions warrant his impeachment and demand his removal from office.
Republican Doug Collins, ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, had this criticism for Democrats.
Why do we keep calling this a solemn occasion when you've been wanting to do this ever since the gentleman was elected? Mr. President came forward and did what he saw fit for the American people, but yet they wanted to impeach him. And see, it hit me. Now I know. The reason they wanted to is now they're realizing what I told them and have been telling them for the last few weeks, that the clock and the calendar are terrible masters. The clock and the calendar are terrible masters. They do not care about anything except getting the time done and the calendar fixed. They do not care about facts. They do not care about time. And one day, the clock and the calendar will hang along this body in a very detrimental way. How do I know this? Because one of our members, Ms. Tlaib, said on the night she was sworn in, we're going to impeach. Well, you know the rest. In May of 2019, Al Green said, I'm concerned if we don't impeach this president, he will get reelected. That is probably the most prescient thing said by the majority in the last year, is they said we can't beat him if we don't impeach him. There's a reason behind this impeachment. And even Speaker Pelosi said it would be dangerous to leave it to voters to determine whether President Trump stays in office. Really? After we just said the Pledge of Allegiance, we go back to the Speaker's own words and said it would be dangerous to leave it to the voters? I will tell you right now, Madam Speaker, we on the Republican side have no problem taking our case to the majority and to the people of this country because they elected Donald Trump, and it is a matter for the voters, not this House, not in this way, not in the way this is being done. It has trampled everything this House believes in. I said it yesterday, and I believe it to be this true today. I will fight this on process, which has been deplorable, to use a word of the majority. It has been awful. The calendar and the clock make it impressive that we actually do it quickly. We don't care about rules. We don't care about minority hearing days. We don't care about giving the opportunity for witnesses to be called because the chairman gets to determine what is relevant. Wow, that's pretty good. Let the accuser determine what is relevant to the one being accused. The people of America see through this. The people of America understand due process, and they understand when it is being trampled in the people's house. You see, it's also not a matter of process, which will be discussed today. It's a matter of actual facts. I will fight the facts all day long. Because what we found here today is a president who did not do as being charged. In fact, they had to go to abuse of power, this amorphous term that you're going to hear many, many arguments about how that abuse of power, except for one thing. The call itself, the two parties say no pressure. Nothing was ever done to get the money. In fact, they didn't even know the money was held. But there is something that very much bothers me about the facts. There were five meetings, we'll hear about those today, in which it was never a linkage made. There was one witness that is depended on over 600 times in the majority's report that in the end, after questioned, had to say, well, that was my presumption of what was happening. You see, this is an impeachment based on presumption. This is an impeachment, basically also a poll-tested impeachment on what actually sells to the American people. Today is going to be a lot of things. What it is not is fair. What it is not is about the truth.
Just some of the sound from the floor of the House today. A vote on the two articles of impeachment is expected this evening.
Scientists from the University of Copenhagen have recreated the genome of a Stone Age woman after examining her DNA from 5,700-year-old chewing gum. It's the first time researchers have been able to reconstruct a human genome from non-human material. Previously, they were only able to extract a human genome from bone. The findings were just published in the science journal Nature Communications. If you're wondering, that chewing gum is actually birch pitch, made by heating the bark of birch trees. It's long been used as a glue-like material for construction tools. Archaeologists believe the birch pitch was chewed to soften it before use. The birch pitch gum was discovered at an archaeological site on an island in Denmark. The scientists also identified DNA of plants and animals consumed by the woman, including hazelnuts and duck, and the DNA of microbes that were in her mouth. Well, as online shopping increases, Amazon has put scores of mom-and-pop shops across the nation out of business, and now it is putting pressure on a local favorite in Nashville. The company just opened a brick-and-mortar bookstore across the street from one of the city's beloved independent bookshops. WPLN's Rachel Iacovone has the story.
Parnassus Books looks small from the outside, but when you enter the shop, it stretches back past your line of sight. It's there, in a small office tucked into the corner, that Ann Patchett answers the always-ringing phone.
Parnassus Books.
Patchett is Parnassus's co-owner, a best-selling author herself, and today, a customer service rep.
It is so possible. It's not just possible, it's probable.
Patchett decided to open this bookstore 8 years ago, in large part because she couldn't find a local place to carry one of her own novels. They'd all closed down. Desperate, she ended up talking her tailor into selling it.
You could have your pants shortened and buy a copy of State of Wonder.
That was long before online retail giant Amazon announced it would open a bookstore in the same neighborhood. Patchett says she's up for the challenge.
I sort of feel like, okay, I'm going to put on the Joan of Arc suit and stand up for independent bookstores.
Books may have been around since before the Hundred Years' War, but bookstores constantly come and go. Before the 1990s, almost every bookstore you'd come across was independent. But then came big box names like Barnes & Noble, Borders, and Books A Million. They pushed out one in three independent bookstores. Later that decade, their momentum was slowed by the launch of Amazon. Then, for many big box retailers, the kill shot came in 2007, when Amazon launched the Kindle e-reader. As the big stores went out of business, an opportunity was created for independent booksellers to rebound, including Parnassus, which salvaged lights and shelves from a closed down Borders.
In fact, the chairs that we use for events also came from my Borders store.
That's Andy Brennan. He was the former manager of a local Borders and now manages Parnassus. Parnassus has thrived by focusing on boutique services like personalized recommendations, age and interest specific book clubs, and author events.
In the first month that we were open, I think I brought those chairs out and set them up more times than I ever did in my 6 years at Borders.
Across the country from Parnassus, in Seattle, there's a similar shop called University Bookstore. Pam Cady has been its manager for 38 years.
I love books, and I love people who buy books. It's a great combination.
Cady's store has been in business for more than a century, but 5 years ago, it found itself in Parnassus's shoes. That's when the very first Amazon Books opened half a mile away. After some initial fear, Cady soon learned the only thing her shop had in common with Amazon's new store was the books part of its name.
Well, you walk in and it's very tech-oriented. They want you to sign up for Amazon Prime. They get all of your information. It's like, how can we design a store for the future, for what they want the future to be?
Amazon doesn't disagree. They say their devices are a big part of their brick-and-mortar business. Their book selection is limited to top online sellers. The goal isn't necessarily to sell books, but to draw in foot traffic for bigger buys, like Alexa devices.
Have you guys ever tried to wash a dog?
Back at Parnassus, on any given Thursday, you can find a gathering of little ones listening with wide-eyed enthusiasm to a volunteer reader. Today, the kids have chosen dog-related books for weekly story time, and they get through half a dozen before playtime begins on the store's popular train table. Margaret Watson has brought her five-year-old.
We were actually getting a cookie after school at the bakery next door, and Jack, my son, said that he wanted to go to the bookstore.
Jack is leading the younger kids in a competition of who can get their train down the tracks fastest. As a Nashville native, Watson takes her son to Parnassus to relive some of her own childhood spent at a since-closed independent bookstore across the street.
I have really good memories of just being there and spending a lot of time there, you know, with my parents, and I love it here. It's really nice.
When Watson found out Amazon was opening just feet away, she was concerned her and Jack's favorite weekday stop would be affected. But then she thought about how stress-free a trip to Parnassus is for parents.
It's pretty easy to access, which is, like, humongous if you have a child. You know, going to the mall is just, there's no way we would do that after school.
Amazon opened its doors in late November, but Parnassus says it's here to stay. For Here and Now, I'm Rachel Iacovone.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.